This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you very much today for joining us for a live edition of Midrats. Except for those that are getting the podcast, and it's not live, but it's live for us, and so that's what makes it all exciting. But it's a unusual show today. No guest today. It's just going to be Eagle One and myself for a midsummer melee. That means we're open topic, we're open chat room, we are open phones. Hardly everybody takes us up on that, but I want to go ahead and stick it out there. If we do have a listener who's with us live that would like to call in and would like to hear us pontificate about things we know little about, whatever that topic may be, you can go ahead, though we prefer something in the maritime arena, area code.
That would almost be any topic, actually.
Pretty much. Hey, we'll fake it till we make it. We'll stumble onto something that makes sense. But area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. And hey, you heard him, everybody's favorite bearded one, Eagle One. Good afternoon.
Hey there, Sal. How are you today?
I'm better than I deserve to be. Hopefully everybody is surviving this. I actually went and got a COVID-19 test.
Yeah, but that's because you had someone in your workspace with a positive, right? Just positive.
Yep, that's right. I had one of my folks tested positive, but she's asymptomatic.
That's good news.
Yeah, it is. So I went and got tested, and took 20 minutes to find out. So I was down to 15% on my iPhone. So she came in just in time because, you know, here we are in 2020. I don't think anybody knows how to sit quietly in a room by themselves anymore with just their own internal dialogue. Though I was preparing myself to be back in, God, wasn't that long ago. What was it? 2011, whatever that was.
Yeah. Well, we were laughing about this earlier. I said, you know, I can't remember. We had FaceTime with one of our kids, and I was complaining that my thumb was sore. Well, and my wife goes, you've been holding a mouse too much. I said, think about 50 years ago. Somebody said, you've been holding a mouse too much. I mean, you get some pretty strange looks.
The past is a foreign country.
It is.
No, yeah, people forget why front porch? Well, people are actually kind of rediscovering front porches again in some ways. But you'd sit on the front porch just because if you wait long enough, something will come into view that you could talk about because you're tired of being inside being talked at. I'm going to sit on the front porch for a while. So that's okay, though. But yeah, here we are just one click away. Speaking of the past being a foreign country, I know – I guess one of the things that I like about what we've been doing the last decade and change is, with a couple of exceptions here and there, we usually avoid the real snarly topics. But I wanted to kind of venture in there just because I think we've brought this up maybe once, maybe twice over the course of the decade. But while I am still a spring chicken, so to speak, you, sir, however, have a little bit more
wisdom. The spring has sprung.
Yeah. You have a little more wisdom and experience than I have in the ways of the world. And you have a way of tapping into a memory that I have only seen in memory books. Well, there's a Freudian slip. History books, what other people have told me secondhand. And it goes off of, you know, one of the news from last week, and I think it was the right thing for him to do. And I think a lot of the articles don't cover this, but when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, and SecDef found themselves walking through Lafayette Square, they didn't know really they were going to wind up there. They were at a meeting with all the cool kids. All the cool kids got out, hung out for a while, and this wasn't on slide, the top three PowerPoint slides, what they were about to do, and they just found themselves there. And it took a while for them to do, which I understand. But I think General Miley came up and, you know, just made a quick statement about the walk through Lafayette Square. I'll do a little quote here. But, quote, "I should not have been there. My presence in that moment and in that environment created a perception of the military involved in domestic politics. As a commissioned uniformed officer, it was a mistake that I have learned from, and I sincerely hope all can learn from it." In the article, I had also had a quote from former Midrats guest, John Kirby, as well. But I think he made that statement right out, and rightfully so, because I think one thing that the military should be proud of is we have always done our best, as imperfect as we are, to try to lead the nation in relations with people of different race and ethnicities. Part of that being is we are diverse. We are not South Dakota. We are not the South Side of Chicago. We are not Miami. We are Tucson. We are the entire country. And as such, we've got everybody in there. People are subject to the sensitivities of the environment around them. And when you're on board, especially in the Navy, though he's an Army guy, Miley, I know in the Navy especially, when you're on board an aircraft carrier, you're on board a submarine, you're on board a replenishment ship with hundreds to thousands of your shipmates in close proximity, you've got to have the issues going on in the culture taken care of really fastly and effective by leadership. And I think the military doing that to make sure that we have the right people, maybe oversaying a few things, but I think it's better to overcorrect to make sure that everybody's got the message than undercorrect. That's kind of my long lead way of coming in to talk about what you saw in person, the racial conflict in the country and the Navy in the early 70s, a different planet than what it is right now. Admiral Zumwalt made some significant steps to do the best as anyone can in those circumstances to try to keep the Navy in the right direction. I just wanted to tap in just for a couple minutes at the start of the show. You know, what do you remember about the 70s that we did right, and how what you remember might be helpful for those that weren't there to experience when looking at what Miley and others have tried to do in the last week or so?
Oh, well, first thing is General Miley was exactly right to do what he did. Most, although there are a lot of presidents who've used military personnel for photo op situations, sometimes the leadership of the military has intentionally stepped aside during the political part of whatever was being addressed, a press conference or whatever, which is exactly right. I mean, the guidance that is out there on, and we hear this all the time on this show, when we have active duty military officers on here or employees of the federal government, they either themselves or ask us to do that general disclaimer about, you know, my views are my views and don't represent the government of the United States or any branch of the military or whatever they usually say. So he was right, and he got, again, I think you were right, he got caught up in kind of a moment, and it was good to apologize. Now, that being said, most of the stuff that not only did I was in the military in the 1970s, I was a military brat. And so it was a peculiar institution, and not the same peculiar institution, but it was a peculiar time in our history to be on military bases, Air Force bases where I grew up, where we had African-American sergeants, senior enlisted. There weren't that many African-American officers in those days, but there were a few, and whose kids I interacted with on a daily basis. We went to school together. We played on sport teams together. I'm talking in the 50s and early 60s, long before these changes came to the rest of society. And this was all because President Truman had integrated the services, and and there were a lot of good reasons for that, and a lot of recognition of should have been made for the fact that we had in the past the services had been segregated in ways that were very unfair. But I start off always saying that my father started out before he became an Air Force officer was an Army cavalry officer, and an Army cavalry officer at the start of World War II, when he got called to active duty, he was assigned, I think, to the 10th Cavalry. 10th Cavalry was the Buffalo Soldiers. All his troops, all his senior enlisted, were African Americans. As a result of that experience, my father was probably the least prejudiced man I've ever met, who treated all these men as individuals and knew them all well. And he, as things progressed, he was very happy to see, when the services were integrated, that the people who were formerly treated so poorly had a chance to advance and to become professionals and go through the services. So that was the environment I grew up in. We did not know how much prejudice these families and the people we worked with, my dad worked with, and I played with, how much discrimination they encountered outside the bases. Because we didn't see it on the base. It just wasn't part of our lives, and it certainly wasn't part of my family life. It was a great shock to me when I went to school, college, and I'd been overseas before that, so I really hadn't had much experience except, you know, TV of I did watch the 1963 March on Washington. We knew all about the bombings of the churches in Birmingham. We knew, you see all those things now. You see on newsreels. It was going on in real life in those days. You know, the Bull Connor and Selma and all that stuff. So it was a shock to me to find out how recently the university I attended in North Carolina had been integrated, and it was not a large number of people, but it was a start. You could see things beginning to change in the country, I thought, in a very positive direction. Out in the fleet, I'm not sure when I got out there that things had changed that dramatically, because we had very few, as I said, very few minority officers. In those days, until I think somewhere, I might have been Zumwalt that did this too, a lot of the career fields were not open to it's like the Filipinos could only serve as stewards or, service people until there was a change and they could become, they could strike for any of the ratings. And there was active discrimination. So when you see the film about Carl Brashear, the Navy diver, that rings true. And it was about that time that we began to have some problems on the ships. There were difficulties on the aircraft carrier Kittyhawk. The Navy instituted these programs. We called them Upward, I think, Understanding Personal Worth and Racial Dignity. It was a chance to sit down and discuss at a very primary level, what discrimination was about and what could be done about it. And I think many of the people that I worked with tried very hard to not discriminate. But that's not to say that we were all purists about it, and that what happens is, as you well know, we take people from our own country, and the people that we get all have their own prejudices and biases, and it is a learning experience, and it is work. You have to work at overcoming some of the patterns and practices of your life before you get into a service where everyone is dependent on everyone else for their safety and security. And I think that those changes that were wrought coming about very slowly in the early 70s, it became a little more dramatic as time went on, but it was great to see. As time progressed, you begin to see more chief petty officers, you begin to see more young officers, you get your first very senior officers of flag rank, different ethnicities, and it makes a huge difference because you get a perspective if you talk to people from, I don't care what their background is, but if you talk to them, you get so much more feel for what life is like in the rest of our society. And I think it was encouraged to discuss matters, although sometimes those, even then, especially then, those conversations were extremely difficult, which is a long way of saying, things changed. A lot of good came out of that, I think. And it was, I think the military, the Navy at that time, and the military in general were probably a little bit ahead of where civil society was because, if you're a Marine on a and you're going into a fight, and we were doing that in Vietnam at the time, the guy on the right, you don't care whether he's purple, green, blue, black, or whatever, your life is in his hands and his life is in yours, and you have to fight to protect each other. And I think that realization and sharing close quarters help a lot of people, just like you see in the World War II movies where the people in a platoon or whatever come to know, a guy from the Bronx and a guy from Keokuk, Iowa or someplace. They learn to get along because they have to learn to get along. And then they find out that the other person has value and merit and can do a good job. And that's when you get to the point where you no longer, discrimination has no place. So that's a long way of saying things got better.
Well, it was interesting listening to you, talk about growing up, and it reflects in some ways what my kids have told me as well, to a lesser extent, because there was there was a lot less of a incline, so to speak, to the problem than there are now. It's mostly just about how people relate. Because the formative years for my kids, a lot of which were spent overseas and going to international schools and things like that. So it can be interesting coming back into a culture that is yours but is unrecognizable in some ways. And there's a lot for us to be proud of, especially in the military. I mentioned to somebody the other day, the least I've lived all over the U.S. and I've been all over the world, and the least racist people I've ever run into are in the U.S. military of all colors. So, everybody could be improved. Everything could be improved, but it's something the U.S. military should be, should jealously guard the process we've made, because throughout history, not very many societies have done it. So anyway, I guess that's our after-school special for the day. But I thought it was an important topic, and I have, unfortunately, you've seen it here and there of ladies and gentlemen of your generation, but there's precious little talk, I think, about where in very much living memory this country has been, and where it has arrived. And while it's sometimes fun and entertaining to focus on negatives and problems and point accusing fingers at institutions, there's a lot of good things that have done and good benchmarks out there that should at least be mentioned now and then. Speaking of history and benchmarks, another thing I'd like to talk about here, because it kind of taps into your background, but I know of more than one person that has, when they have their reasons for staying in or getting out of the Navy, at least on the surface side, a big demotivator for some people is like, I spent 9 months in the yards, and that was just it for me. I hated going to the yards. I'm leaving active duty. So they go out and they stay in the reserves. I'm laughing with them, not at them. But lo and behold, the Navy has called up 1,600 reservists to go into the shipyards for a year. And they're calling up, let's see the actual number, 1,629 reservists to reduce carrier and submarine maintenance backlog. They're going to be bringing in electricians, pipe fitters, sheet metal workers, plumbers, hydraulic technicians, a lot of HTs in the reserves, I guess, mechanics, machinists, carpenters, welders, and more. That was from Captain Michael McLean over at NAVC. And Portsmouth Naval Shipyard up in Kittery, Maine, is getting 267. Norfolk Shipyard will get 486. And we're going to get 676 split over at Puget Sound in Bremerton. And a few lucky sailors will be going to Pearl Harbor to receive 200 of them. And we've talked about that more than once, not this directly, but more than once during the course of Midrats about the maintenance schedule, depot level maintenance, what we lost when the accountants decided to show us how efficient we could be by getting rid of a lot of our naval shipyards. I guess in some ways, this is part of a learning institution going, okay, enough of the excuses and sliding to the right. We just need to make stuff happen. Thank you for your service and your future service. Here's your invitation. Has the reserves outside of our desert Navy activations after 9/11, have we seen that many reservists recalled for something like this before?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, first let me say that I've spent more than my share of time at shipyards and, you know, Mare Island, San Francisco, Portsmouth, and Subic Bay, and I would never want to go to one ever again. but, you know, that's when you're on the ship crew and you're trying to sleep, and there's guys with needle guns outside your berthing compartment, and, you know, you can't, if you refer to them as sand crabs, they get upset.
Hopefully shipmates won't be actually living on board. They'll have them in reasonable accommodations.
Well, that's my hope, but, you know, calling up reserves and reasonable accommodations have not always gone together hand in hand. So
I didn't mean to trigger anybody in the audience with the call in and scream at me.
And Lord knows, I mean, if these guys have these kind of skills, you know, they're pretty much in demand, and I would think in the civilian community. And so I'm a little concerned about there may be some pay differential issues here. And I, you know, I don't know if these are volunteer.
Yeah.
They're 1,629 volunteers, and you know, I don't know how this works out with the union shipyard unions and their. I know this is all because of COVID-19, but the unions have, what do they call those guys? The apprentice programs and stuff.
Yep.
You know, are these reservists going to be viewed as scabs of some kind, almost like strike breakers or what? I'm not aware. I mean, I know that for various odd jobs, every now and then they'll call up a clump of reservists to do things, but I don't remember specifically a group being called, you know, a group being called up to work in shipyard. That's a new one on me.
I mean, I'm just picturing, you know, 486 new people showing up in Norfolk and saying, hi guys, we're here. I mean, that's not an insignificant number of people. And I think it does beg the question. It's like, okay, we've identified a 1600 person shortfall for 1 year. Rust never sleeps. Maintenance goes on. And, you know, another thing that we'll talk on later on, especially when you know, ships stay at sea for extended lengths of time. So do we keep doing this? Can we keep doing this? Or do we have some way that we can incentivize if we're not going to go back to how we used to do things, at least the private sector, you know, how do we incentivize the training, maintenance, and sustainability of shipyard workers, which, as you alluded to earlier, these are good-paying jobs. You know, that guy with the welding torch in his hand, he came to work in a $70,000 truck because he makes a good bit of cheese. These are not, you know, the old videos of the 1920s of the poor, starving shipyard workers. Now, these are craftsmen these are talented men and women who get paid well, because especially if you're a nuclear certified welder, you're an artisan in many ways. I don't know how you find a way to create these people in any sustainable way, because it may have been the other Sal that we had on. I don't remember. Maybe somebody else who have talked about they've had programs in the past where they got these people trained up, and then lo and behold, the politics changes and your defense budget is 20% of what it was supposed to be, and these people go away and they never come back. I would be really interested to see the slide deck that explained why this needs to be done. I support it. Anything we can do to get our ships in proper shape, but there's a sustainability issue on the other end that I think is an untold story.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've had any electrical or plumbing work done around your homes or businesses, but you know those guys don't work for free. So I'm very curious as to how this works, and I've never heard. I didn't know there was a surge maintenance program, but I guess there is. So, I guess it's been around. Well, I'm looking at one something now. It says 2005 reserve surge main team. So, okay.
Yeah, you know, the good captain. This may have been his. Well, you know, I've got another 24 months till I retire. What do you got for me, detailer? Well, there's this thing called surge main. We need a good qualified 06 over at NAVSE. It's a pretty quiet job. And all of a sudden, he's got 1,629 spouses having his picture against the dartboard. But who knows? Maybe these folks might be an opportunity for him. But I don't think any of these jobs are things that have been impacted by COVID-19, at least not yet. But at least they know they're going to have a steady paycheck for a year, and they'll get that active duty time credit. So there's a variety of ways to spin it, but hopefully the disruption on people's lives is minimal, because ultimately they're having to do this because of decisions that were made in the last 20 years that were based on hope and not what we knew would eventually have to be done, which is sad.
Yeah, I mean, some of what I'm saying, just based on ignorance, apparently this program has been around for at least 15 years, maybe even longer than that. I mean, I'm looking at the report, as I said, from 2005.
It could be called something else.
No, it was called Surge Main. So, you know, it's I didn't know, and bad on me for not knowing, because I should know things like that.
Well, it may have been one of those things. We've seen other jobs in other areas that you maintain a list of people in case the balloon goes up, you know who to call. It's like, hello, I'm from the government. I'm here to invite you to something. And it's just they've decided we've got to activate it. But, that would be an interesting story to know what the background is on that. I think it's great, because there's, as we've talked about here, many hours over the course of the years, the maintenance backlog is not insignificant. It doesn't look like any of this is going to help people in Japan, but I guess if you get enough money, you can get enough time in the Japanese shipyards. Japanese shipyards do great work. So hopefully our four deployed naval forces in Japan and Spain will be getting a little bit of love with that, or maybe not.
Yeah, I would probably be trolling money down through the former workers in the Subic Bay Naval Shipyard and stuff, because they also did great work. But you know, maybe those days are gone forever, and we won't have those, because I really enjoyed working with the Filipino shipyard people.
Yeah, I heard they really did good work. You know, it's really a shame because, as you know, if you've been in the Navy for any length of time, though it's not as true now because of the way things change than it was when I was a wee pup and older, it's now even second and third generation, but Filipinos and Filipino Americans have always served in our Navy and a larger percentage than they are the general population. Great sailors, great officers, just wonderful people. But and when we're in the Philippines, you know, you mentioned the shipyard workers. I've never spent any time in the Philippines, but I've served the people who did. Always great work. Everybody has a relative or a friend in the U.S. But since last few decades, the official relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines has not been a positive one. And I've never really fully understood that. Maybe it's a post-colonial thing. I really don't know, but there's just such a disconnect between the Filipino and Filipino Americans that I knew and served with. And then you look at how our two governments, or at least our two government politicians, get along, and that does translate into business that we do or can't do in Subic Bay. And the Chinese have stepped in there pretty big, as they have everywhere else, but they have, how can I put this nicely? They have certain business practices that we can't replicate. It's hard to compete with.
Yeah. A lot of the disconnect between, there is a post-colonial, there's also our support for the Marcos regime, which was most unfortunate. And then there's this, some structural issues in the Philippines themselves about those that have and those that have not, that are part, you know, I guess part and parcel, or at least a part of the colonial structure we left in place. And that, you know,
and
that's
we inherited
yeah.
from Spain.
Yes,
I remember
absolutely.
back in college, I forget what class it was. I want to say it was political science, but it may have been one of my other classes. They actually had us read a bit about, it was based upon people's last names in the Philippines, because some Filipino names are Spanish. Some of them obviously are not. And it had to be who were the elite, who were allowed to keep their names, who could not compete their names, and how the Spanish, kind of like how the Belgians did in Rwanda, pick certain families and groups to be administrators and have power. And when we went in there, we took that over, and it's just, yeah, it's a mess. And unfortunately, we got some of that mess on us. I guess our problem with the Filipino people and supporting Marcos is kind of like our problem with some Iranians and the support of the Shah. It was what it was.
Yeah, and it went back even before World War II. There were a lot of Filipino leaders who wanted independence before we were before the U.S. was willing to give it up. And I'm not, you know, there. If you go through the whole history from the Spanish American War, where we ended up with the Philippines for a while, and the promises were made and the things that actually happened, you know, it's not a very pretty part of our history, because we were never intended to be a colonial power, and I don't think we did it very well, and I'm glad we got out of it. But it is what happened, so you can't really bury it anyplace.
Yeah, it is what it is. But for our 1600 and change naval reservists who are about to go to the shipyards, I hope you don't wind up on board the ships. I hope you don't wind up on a berthing barge. Hopefully they'll take good care of you, because it might be a naval reserve recruiting issue down the road if they don't. And by the way, for the listeners,
I was just looking at the Navy. The Navy does have a whole since 2000. What did I say? 2006, I think the Surge Main program has been around. So it's a lot older program than I knew, and apparently they do actively recruit people for it. So maybe there's just a big core of people who are all ready to go.
Yep, and if the listeners out there, I've looked around, I can't find any more meaty details on it. Because I'm a little bit of a geek, I think it's a fascinating topic to look into. If anybody knows of an article and, I don't know, professional magazine or a brief they can send our way that explains it, I'd love to see it, and I'll forward it over to my illustrious co-host as well. But I think it would be a fascinating story, and to know how that works and to know how we got here and what the plan is down the road. So I'll just do a hell call out to my listeners, and we'll see what happens. Over in the chat room, Chiz73, who I'm not sure who that is, so hello, but he was asking about FFGX decision. We've talked about it on a few shows. We didn't do a dedicated show on the topic of FFGX recently, but it kind of turned out the way at least I wanted it with the Frim. I think it's going to be a while till we have a hull displacing water, but hopefully that doesn't mean they can delay it long enough to kill it. But just speaking from the cheap seats, I'm looking forward to Flight 2 because Flight 1 just has a 57-millimeter, and that ship can take 127-millimeter, i.e. 5-inch multipurpose gun, which is a lot more useful to the crew than a 57-millimeter gun. So I'm looking forward to Flight 2 to repair the compromises that were made for Flight 1 of the ship. But, we never did a dedicated show, but we have talked about it a fair bit, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. I think... we didn't specifically. We may have even talked about how they did the selection down to this particular version, but it was one of the ones I know you were pushing as a good possibility. And I'm uncertain about the. I hate to say this, but except for the Marines, I'm uncertain about the naval. The need for a larger. Gun on these things because I'm not sure if you're that close depending on what you're doing if you're that close you've got more issues than you need.
Well, when in doubt, larger caliber the better. That's just one of my hobby horses I like to ride on. So
you're not a 16 gauge or 20 gauge man. You always go with a 12.
Actually, I would love to turn this into a honey podcast because I can talk for an hour on that topic right there. Actually, I have in my dotage, the only time I will carry a 12-gauge in the field is when I am duck hunting. When I go out 2-3 years ago, last time when I was out chasing pheasants and quail in Kansas, I took my 20 gauge with me and said, I'm going to carry this for a while because this is quail and pheasant country. So I'd have 7.5 shot in the lower, and then I had prairie steel number 5s in the upper two. And because when you're out, for those that haven't been quail hunting and pheasant hunting in Kansas, if you're doing it right, you and your dog are, at least the humans walk at 8 to 10 miles. The dogs are doing double that. There's a lot of time on your feet. And I said, I'm going to carry this 20. And I shot just as good as I did with the 12 on it, and that, pound and a half less makes a difference when you're walking through high grass 8 to 10 miles a day. The 20 is fine with me. 16s are sexy, but I don't own one. I've shot them. It's on my buy list. So I'm not that fanatic, but that's where appropriate. This is, I guess, where you can shoot back at me. Well, actually, the 57 millimeter is very appropriate for the following. So I'm willing to admit that bigger isn't always better. There are compromises and there are trade-offs. However, I don't think that we went with a 57 millimeter for an appropriate trade-off besides giving the LCS options a chance for FFGX, though I'm willing to be sold. The 57 millimeter is better than the 30 millimeter. I'll compromise that way.
Okay. I'll go with that.
Yeah. If anybody ever really wants to be bored, ask me about dogs or shotguns, and you'll eventually just hang up on me. That's
well,
cool.
I think one of the other things that I really like about this new ship is that the habitability for the crew is much improved.
Amen.
over other current Navy ships, and that is a very good thing.
It's interesting, you know, when you look at, it's almost an afterthought, you know, things we can learn from our European friends. For instance, the, I don't know if the illicit accommodations were different, but the officer accommodations on the kid class DDGs that we gave to the Taiwanese, moment of silence for the USS Scott, one of my favorite ships. They, because it was going to what was then the Imperial Iranian Navy, they upped the game on that spruance hull, and the berthing was much nicer for the officers than on your standard spruance. But the European ships do have nicer accommodations in that regard. I would love to ask that question too. I know we've had a lot of officers that have done tours on the Charles de Gaulle, or if any of our Royal Navy friends had done time on a U.S. carrier and then had been on the new Queen Elizabeth class, I'd be interested to see how the British accommodations are. But you're right about the Frem. It's your retention numbers will be good with that burden. You still there? Or did you forget your mute button?
Oh, I guess that on-off switch again. It keeps fooling me. Somebody was asking. Yeah, because if you can't master that, what can you master? I think Paul was asking about why the 57 millimeter over the 125, and I think it has to do with the cost of the ammunition, and I'm not sure how much I think that 57 millimeter has a faster rate of fire, if I'm not mistaken, but I. And you know, it's a generic thing, and it can be upgraded. So
and if they had chosen anything but a 57 millimeter, then the two people presently building the LCS would not have been able to compete with the program, because you cannot modify the LCS hull for anything larger than a 57 millimeter. That was 51% of the reason why they mandated the 57 millimeter as the acceptable and what they wanted to have in there. There are other valid reasons, but yeah, if they had done anything else, then the two versions of the LCS would not have been able to compete for the program. So yeah, there have been worse compromises made in programs before, but we'll see. Now the depending upon you have the French have, I believe, one version. The Italian have two. One's a general purpose. One is an ASW focused. Their ASW focused version has twin 76 millimeters and the IE 3-inch. And the multi-purpose has 127 millimeter gun. None of the European versions have 57. The smallest they have is 76 millimeter. So the hull, if the Navy decides they want to have a flight two, at which point you can leave the cost requirements for the initial competition. If the Navy decides that there's a value to be added in a larger gun, the Frem hull can take it, whereas other options that were put forward wouldn't have had that option. I don't think that played into the decision. That's my fantasy world. That is a nice feature for people to keep in their background.
Yeah, I mean, it's got theoretically, it has a maximum firing rate of 220 rounds per minute, which, you know, that's pumping some shells out there with a 57 millimeter. I haven't found yet the firing rate of the 125, but I have the feeling it's a little bit lower than that. That's, you know, and it's, yeah, it's an odd, also it is an automatic remote mount, which for what that's worth.
And with modern ships, you know, you get hit with one of these. I don't care whether it's 57 millimeter, 127 millimeter. If you get hit with one of those high explosive rounds, with how thin hulled ships are nowadays, you're going to get a mission kill. You may not sink it, but it's not going to be a threat to you. But what the 57 and to a lesser extent the 76 millimeter brings to the game that the 57 doesn't, it's range, extended range, in an AAW environment, and to be able to, as the fancy people say, create effects ashore, especially if you throw some change at the Italians with their volcano rounds that they've done for both the 76 and the 127 millimeter. But that's a maybe, coulda, woulda, shoulda. I think the 57 will be fine to have. It's what the other aspects of the platform, I think, will get the job done. I'm just glad we went that way.
Yeah, the rate of fire for the 127 millimeter is about 32 rounds per minute. So, you know, if you're doing as Paul was asking, the rate of fire makes a big difference if you're going for these small boat swarm attack kind of things. So there is something to be said for it. And, you know, again, those of us who are in the NGFS world, whatever they call it now, you know, we're not going to be supporting. We're not going to get our ships close enough to support them with anything less than maybe and even then with a, you know, 16-inch gun. So that kind of leaves out some of these smaller ships.
Hey, let's shift the flag over a little bit. Speaking of destroyers and carrying guns all over the place and stuff, because this is another topic that we've touched on a bit. One of the byproducts of COVID-19, at least that's one of the excuses being used, is we saw from the Truman Carrier Strike Group, the Normandy and the Forrest Sherman, they both returned to Norfolk last week, underway for 267 days. That's a long deployment. And that same strike group, the... who are those other two? The Lassen and the Farragut. They're now, I think they're still there. They're down with the 4th Fleet doing SOCOM's anti-drug efforts. They're going to return sometime in the middle of this month soon, I hope. Maybe next week. That would be the last of mid-June, or maybe it's late June. So they still went to sea. Aster, and we did some nice shows that I'm proud of back in 2017 and 2018 about what we saw in Westpac, not just for the Fitzgerald and the McCain, but the other incidents back there, how lack of maintenance and lack of rest, lack of training were contributing factors to those incidents. Yeah, and we've talked a lot about how our COCOM system can be warping on why we do what we do. And when I look at what these ships have actually done, just because we can do something doesn't mean we should do something. 9 months is a hell of a long deployment. 6 months, you know, you're ready to go home. What in a time of relative peace, which we are, why are we doing this to our ships for 9 months? I did a post this week on it, and I really didn't get any, what at least for me, were satisfying answers. Because we can, because a COCOM wants us to. I don't know if that is a long-term view on a long-term issue when it comes to ship maintenance, personnel retention, and quality of life. I mean, have you seen anything that is that can sell me on a different thought toward these shipmates spending that much time at sea for a farthing?
Well, we probably don't have the big picture, but we do know that they just called up 1,600 some odd reservists to go to shipyards to do maintenance, and all these things, everything is tied together somewhere. And, I'm wondering if they had to extend these guys, because they aren't getting the ships that they were supposed to have rotated out of their maintenance cycles in a timely manner. But they think that if they extend these guys and they get on this different kind of rotation, that it's going to be able to work it out in the long run. So somebody has to pay the short-term price and in order to get the system back on some kind of even keel. But yeah, 9 months is long. I mean, I spent an 11-month deployment, and the good news was we were so busy that and we could you know, we could pop into Subic, or we could pop, you know, we would go to other places to get some R&R. But, you know, 11 months with anybody, 11 months with your wife in a small room is hard. So it's a challenge, but the busier, and I just hope they're not out there cutting holes in the ocean, because the busier you are, the faster time goes by, the better you get at your profession. That, you know, those are the good sides of it. The bad sides are that it's 11 or 9 months. That's a long time to be away from other things.
Especially when you're due to come home from deployment in April, and there's nothing that defines cutting a hole in the ocean worse, especially for a Arleigh Burke class destroyer, than counter drug operations in the Caribbean. And they're not getting any liberty. They're not pulling into any ports. They are with each other. Hope you love your shipmates. And you know, you brought up a good point. You know, there are, well, there used to be, epic, whether you are, and I don't mean this in a negative way, I mean this in a very positive way. They're lovely people. They're great shipmates. But it doesn't matter whether you are a highly observant Mormon or you are a hellraiser from Philly. You know, Westpac, there were great liberty ports. Hong Kong, Singapore, Philippines, Japan. If you're really lucky, you pulled into Australia. There were great places to go. In the Mediterranean, oh, please, throw me in Haifa for 4 days. I'll see you on the other end. You know, Suda Bay, Khan. We could go on for a while. Baltops, please. They're great places. That was part of being in the Navy. That was part of retention. That was part of the deal that we made with folks. Hey, we're going to deploy you for 6 months, but you know what? You're going to get 3 days in Haifa. You're going to get 4 days in Trieste. If you're I know our ship movements are classified, but when we pull into Rota, there'll be about 130 spouses waiting for us there. When we pull into Laverno, there'll be another 125 waiting for you, so you might get a chance to see your wife during deployment, et cetera, and so forth. But then say, no, you're not going to do that, and you're going to go for 9 months, and it's hard to really see why. I think I had a couple people tell me, well, you got to understand what the COCOMs are doing. And that goes back to, you know, one of our hobby horses we talked about before, how we've got to fix that. And I don't know whether we are really taking to heart what we said we were going to take to heart after 2017, when we have ships like the Lassen and the Farragut, who were supposed to be home in April. Their other battle group support ships have gone home to Norfolk, but they're like, nah, you're going to stay at sea for another month to go displace water in the Caribbean. I'm willing to be sold, but man, I don't hear a pitch anywhere.
Yeah, I don't. You know, first thing is we have all these useless, not quite useless. We have unnecessarily tied to port LCSs that ought to be out there doing that mission. They got, you know, if there's a job that they would be designed for, that would be the job. Go out and do counter drug ops. Go out and do, because they're high speed, they're got low manning, got nice living quarters, all that good stuff. Just turn them loose. And if we don't have those, for God's sake, let's get some smaller ships. I don't know, they could be offshore oil rig things. Put some JOs and some people out there and let them go have, you know, a squadron of five of these things out cruising around and have a good time. But yeah, take a billion-dollar destroyer and waste the time of both it and the crew. That is a bad decision in my book.
Well, to avoid being that guy. However, you did drag the LCS plush toy out of the dungeon, so I'm gonna slap it a couple of times. I've had a few people get in touch with me the last few weeks talking about the readiness and mechanical issues with LCS. All the critics are right. There's a reason why you're not seeing this huge mass of ships getting underway. I've talked to folks that have done entire tours, seagoing tours on LCS that have never deployed because they can't deploy, because the ship can't deploy. their crew can't deploy. I can think of nothing that would be more disappointing for me as a young JO that I'm on a sea tour and I don't deploy. Why did I join the Navy? I didn't join the Navy to go from shipyard to shore to sapper training. That's you know, the old saw, at least it's true till you get tired of it. You know, sailors belong at ships, ships belong at sea. And sending good officers and sailors on sea duty and not having to see a deployment while we have other ships that are deploying for 9 months. Anyway, I'll put the LCS plush toy back in the dungeon.
No, it's
unfortunate.
That's exactly right. Now that's all I know. We have a couple of LCSs out in Singapore and some of those that have deployed from San Diego that are actually doing Navy business. Great, you know. But we have a whole bunch of these things, and I'm not sitting there looking at them sailing out of port or anything. But it seems to me that if you can't make the long deployment, then you can sure go to the Caribbean for a couple of months and cycle those guys in and out of there. I mean, how hard would that be? And I just am baffled by why we don't do it. Maybe they're expensive to run. I don't have any idea. But
yeah, when your reduction gearbox needs to be changed and they're cutting holes in your hull, it's kind of hard to deploy. Poor thing. And that's just that. Here's something that kind of caught my eye. Some of the listeners here may follow Brian McGrath on Twitter, and he made an interesting comment the other day. It was right on. And at my home blog, he did a guest post, unsolicited advice for the new SecNav Brathwaite. I can't pronounce that name. It's too English for me. has too many vowels. Brathwaite. Help me out here, shipmate. Anyway, the new SecNav has been fairly quiet. And that's one of the recommendations that Brian made to him, is to be quiet and focused. And another former MidRats guest, Admiral Moran, one of his before he, and everybody knows the background why he didn't become CNO. But one of the things that I was looking forward to with Admiral Moran's tenure as CNO was the fact that that gentleman knew the budget. He knew the hill. He knew the process. He knew the money. He knew where money was hidden because he helped hide it. He knew where the money was supposed to be, but it wasn't because he told people how to make it. I mean, he knew the system. And you can work a system for good or you can work the system for bad. And I knew Admiral Moran knew the system and he was going to work it for good. And we lost that opportunity. And he did the new SecNav actually, you know, broke radio silence and did an interview with Megan Eckstein. I think she did the interview with Megan. If not, somebody please correct me. But he said something that in the interview that really, whether he's going to be on the job for less than a year or longer, we'll find out, is immaterial. But he said, quote, I am actually going to go deeper into the budget than any of my predecessors did, only because I want to own it. I'm coming at this, even though I'm a career naval officer, I'm coming at it with a mindset of a private sector executive wanting to know where some of the inefficiencies are, unquote. Now, there is a red light for me when people say inefficiencies, because I'm more of the cult of the effectiveness, so I hope I don't repeat a mistake. However, in an era of shrinking budgets, if we could have somebody at least try to squeeze what they can out of it without becoming an efficiency cultist, that would be great. That encouraged me.
That is encouraging. And long overdue. I mean, there are so many. I mean, oh boy. One of my hobby horses, you could go through the federal budget and then go out and look at what people actually do for the money that they get paid, and you could, I don't know how many billions of dollars we could actually save by, you know, looking at the Office of Redundancy, to see, you know, can we just get rid of this? And everybody talks about doing it when they get to Washington, but it's, you know, it gets into that too hard pile, but we've got plenty of that in the Navy. I mean, there's plenty of I mean, you know, we spent so much money foolishly on change, innovation, when all the innovation that should have been looked at is already coming to fruition for, you know, with, let's say, just take unmanned stuff. You know, it's clear that the future has huge chunks of unmanned in it. So, you know, when we're focusing, we tend to focus on the wrong stuff because we're always fighting the last war, the war before that. And we need to, you know, we need to, one of the great things about the NavyCon and the use of science fiction and analyzing kind of where we should be going with this stuff is it frees you up from the mistakes of the past. And you can think, well, what if? And we ought to be we ought to have the Department of What If. We used to have a Department of What If, but it's one of the few things that ever got shut down, I guess.
Yeah, and another thing that I'm also worried about, and that we've seen a lot recently, and hopefully that the new SecNav and his team won't fall down this route, that there's a danger in it with some of the words he used, but I can't assume he's going to go the bad way. But I kind of use this analogy, and we've seen it a lot, is in a way we have been somebody who is living in a house that's dated and worn out and decides that we want to upgrade it to a modern facility with all sub-zero appliances, and we're going to rip out the kitchen, we're going to redo the floors, everything we're going to do, and they spend all their money on interior designers and architects, and they got the plans in front of them. Everything looks great and wonderful. And all of a sudden they realize they don't have any money because they spent all their money on the architect and the interior designer. So they can't afford to actually get any of this stuff or make any of these modernizations. So instead they're going to go in the garage, get some baling wire, duct tape, and a soldering iron, and we'll just try to make the best of it that they can. And that is a concern that I had, that we may go through another cycle of this, and we'll have Arleigh Burke flight fours at some point. I don't know.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't know you'd been to my house and looked at my baling water and duct tape. But yeah, I mean, I think that we have to, I hate to say this, but we've got so many mafias, if you will, in our organization. So everybody's protective of some bit of turf, and that caused problems before World War II with the battleship admirals, you know, kind of opposed to the carrier admirals. We're lucky that we had enough people with foresight to push through some really good ideas, which turned out to be invaluable after the battleship proved to be basically useless in World War II. So, you know, we just need to kind of kill some of these mafias. I'm sure the fighter mafia, God, I've got a member of that in my family, they got to be looking over their shoulder at these unmanned aircraft and going, well, you know, we'll always have manned aircraft kind of thought. And you're going, well, maybe that's not necessarily true. But if we don't, what are we going to do?
Yeah, watch decoders. Well, hey, we've spent an hour chatting, as we so easily can do. For those that don't know, usually after the shows, we'll have a little debrief. And sometimes our debriefs will go almost another hour. So it's always easy for us to do a melee. We're going to have a best of next week for Father's Day. So happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. And let me ask you this, what is something over the course of the next month that you're looking for, like another shoe to drop or a subject area that you've been looking at that just hasn't broken above the ambient noise that you hope will soon? What are you looking at there, Eagle One?
Oh, I keep looking at China. I keep thinking that we have not seen that, you know, they're trying to figure out how much of an advantage they can take of what's going on with this, the COVID-19 and what it's done to us. And I also think that in the back of somebody's mind, they're going, geez, this, a simple flu-like virus took them completely out of things. What could we do if we really decided to do something? So I get worried about stuff like that, you know, and it's probably paranoia because I drink a lot of coffee, but maybe it's not coffee paranoia.
Well, you know, like I like to say, you're not being paranoid if people are actually trying not to get you. And so, yeah, you know, another thing I'm looking at, because, again, my mind was focused being that I went and got a COVID-19 test and I'm negative, yay. Looking at what happened to the TR, and everybody is talking about the possibility of a second wave in the civilian world. You know, what if we have another wave kick off on board one of our ships? I think it will be a great tribute to the Navy's Medical Service Corps and the folks in preventative medicine, et cetera, and so forth. If they have managed to work a system that we can get to the end of the year, that we don't have another outbreak on board a ship that, you know, makes the rest of the deployment go boom. Because all the ships that are going to be deploying now, everybody's thoroughly soaked in the opening up of the economy. There's more exposures, more vectors. So that's one thing I'm going to keep an eye on through the end of the year, just to see whether we get that. If so, man, DZ to everybody. If not, it'd be interesting to see how we react.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that the people who are I know that the logisticians of the world, UPS and FedEx and these guys, are really looking hard at the impact of, and if I'm Amazon, I'm going to be happy as hell the way things worked out. But, you know, we've got to look at once again at our infrastructure and in our manufacturing. You know, I know there are a lot of people saying we got to bring stuff back to our own shores, but, you know, I think we can count our shores as our friends and Canada and some other friendly countries. But, we just cannot become dependent for key things on a long supply train, because I'm not sure we have a way. I question whether or not we have the assets to protect ourselves and our allies the way we have over the last 60, 70 years.
Yeah, we need to quickly identify those production capabilities that are essential to, from an existential point of view, to this nation, the same way that we have traditionally looked at raw materials. Access to those items, and, you know, whether they're rare earth metals or other products, national stockpiles, et cetera, and so forth. But if we're relying on an insecure supply path for a critical part of our infrastructure, or, Lord help us all, we're having our number one competitor making it, that's probably not a good call. But, That's 2020. You never know. It's been a pleasure for the hour there, Eagle One. Thank you for our guests for joining us for another edition of BitRats, and we'll see you here soon.
All right. Take care.
Take care, everybody. And as I always say, have a great Navy day, especially those going to the shipyard. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way.